I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
Opinionated and long-suffering. They can't be happy about the Eagles' season opener last Sunday when the team lost to the Green Bay Packers. There were problems with the special teams, and quarterback Donovan McNabb, back after a serious injury last year, looked less than 100%. So can they get their act together for Monday night's game against Washington? What kind of season are they going to have this year, and how does the rest of the NFL look? Well, we've invited two veteran sports analysts to join us today on Radio Time. To let me introduce them to you. Ray Didinger's a writer, sports producer at NFL Films. He's a weekly commentator on Comcast Sportsnet's post-game live show. Say that 10 times fast. Also, he's written a book. It's a compilation of some of his favorite articles on Philadelphia's professional sports teams, and it's called One Last Read. And Ray, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
It's great to be back, Marty.
And Sal Palantonio is national correspondent for ESPN, covering the NFL for Sports Center and for Sunday NFL Countdown, also host of NFL Matchup on Sunday mornings. And he's got a new book. It's called The Palantonio Report, The Most Overrated and Underrated Players, Teams, Coaches, and Moments in NFL History. And Sal, nice to have you back with us as well. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Ray, let me begin with you. And I follow the Eagles intermittently, but it seems that they're never ready when the season starts. Is that my imagination?
No. I mean, statistics would bear that out. I mean, since Andy Reid's been the head coach, this is a team that's won a lot. I mean, they've been in the playoffs every year but two. I mean, his record, he's the winningest coach in Eagles history, but in opening games, right, he's 3-6.
And why do you think that is?
Well, my feeling is that this is a team, it's actually a two-part thing. Preseason football now and training camps now are not what they used to be. They're more about getting through it without anybody getting hurt than getting real work accomplished. So I don't think any team really gets into the regular season opener at maximum efficiency. And if you have a team like the Eagles, which tends to be a team where both on offense and defense, I think they have a lot of moving parts. I think there's, I think timing is a big part of what they do. I think their offense is pretty complex. I think they're a team that probably comes into form a little slower than other teams. And I think you definitely saw that last week. I mean, to me, they are clearly a better team than the Packers. At the end of the year, I'm sure they'll have a better record than the Packers. And they should have certainly won that game, even though it was in Green Bay. But they played they executed poorly on offense. They were sloppy. They made some terrible mistakes and judgments on special teams. And it wound up costing them a game they should have won.
What did you see, Sal, at that game?
Well, I couldn't agree with Ray more, and this is one of the things that I find very aggravating about the Eagles organization, is because the trend line in the NFL now is to rest players during the preseason, and the first game of the regular season almost becomes like the preseason, that you're getting ready and warmed up. So they should have recognized the trend, and some teams that are successful in week one understand that, and some that haven't recognized it are behind the curve. And as a result, if you're not ready in week one, you're going to get embarrassed. And that's what happened. They went to Green Bay and they played a non-playoff caliber team, albeit a team that has now won five straight going back to last season, but is not considered a playoff team this season. And they lost the game specifically because they didn't have a punt returner, which seems to be either the height of arrogance or the height of incompetence.
Huh.
So
is it a mix of both, do you think? Or time will tell?
That's a two-part answer as well. I think, first of all, they invested a lot of time and money in developing Jeremy Bloom, and he was clearly not an NFL-caliber returner or player at any position, and they didn't have a good backup plan, and they cut Bloom at the 11th hour, which was a mistake as well. They should have recognized his limitations much earlier on, and then they were caught with two guys, Greg Lewis and J.R. Reed, who had never returned punts before. Everybody knows this. Everybody in town who follows the team knows this story. And, you know, it's clear to me that now that teams are doing what they're doing in the preseason, that you can steal a game, which is what the Packers basically did from the Eagles. You can steal a game in week one. And if you look at how close the games were in week one, extraordinarily close, this past week one because teams are playing from the same level playing field. They're not prepared.
Huh, and they're not prepared. So, I mean, you both actually agree with that and see that. Special teams, though, for Monday night's game, Ray, are they going to be ready? Time will tell.
You know, I mean, they've brought back Reno Mahe, right, who was their kick returner before.
Right.
But he's had no training camp. His history.
He's out in Utah somewhere, right?
Yeah. He's been out of the game since the end of last season. His history suggests that he at least catches the ball. I mean, he's certainly not an elite kick returner. He's certainly not a threat to score touchdowns. But in the minimalist world of the Eagles are trying to survive in special teams, mm-hmm, somebody that catches the ball looks like a messiah. So, I mean, they'll bring him back, and he'll do that probably. But still, I mean, are they where they should be on special teams? No, because mm-hmm, they've got a guy who has a history of being able to catch the ball. But again, he's only been back practicing for a week. So is he ready to play a Monday night game at regular season tempo? I don't know. Mm-hmm. It just baffled me the whole preseason why they didn't. I mean, this to me was so obvious why they didn't see this thing coming a long way off, mm-hmm, and have someone in camp who was competition for Bloom. Where if you decide that this skier who's been away from football for 3 years, okay, is he worth a chance? Is right. it worth to see what he can do? Right. Maybe you found lightning in a bottle. But if it's not, and the likelihood was it wasn't going to be, and it proved not to be, then have someone else there that's gone through camp with you that you can turn it over to and say, okay, this is the guy we're going with. To be now scrambling around, even with a guy who has some history, to me is no way to be playing regular season football.
But this is basic management, isn't it, Sal? I mean, to get your team ready to play football?
Actually, it's more basic than that. I was part of the 100 million people that watched the Super Bowl. You were, Ray. Did you watch the Super Bowl, Marty?
Of course I watched
the
Super Bowl.
Okay, so you were part of that 100 million people. We can assume that Jeff Lurie, Joe Banner, Tom Heckert, Howie Roseman, Andy Reid, go down the list, all watched the Super Bowl. Devin Hester was an explosive player in the Super Bowl, returner for the Chicago Bears. Devin Hester is one of a group of players in the NFL that have proven that if you spend time and make the right decision on special teams, you can have an impact. I think he returned 4 or 5 last year returns for touchdowns.
6 if you count the Super Bowl.
6 if you count the Super Bowl, right.
Which is a record.
That's a record.
But the point is, this is another aggravating aspect of how they do business. The trend line is speed on special teams. And now you have a guy, Reno Mahe, who, as Ray has pointed out, was the symbol of failure on special teams prior to him being let go. They didn't bring him back for a reason. He was, at best, pedestrian at doing what he was doing on the field, returning punts. Now he's the symbol of a savior. It's silly. He was failure. Now he's saving the team because they didn't come up with plan B.
Well, let's talk about another player, and I'll go back to you, Sal. This is, of course, Donovan McNabb, the quarterback, out most of last year, pretty serious injury. Didn't look like the old Donovan McNabb that we saw a couple of early on in his career in Philadelphia. What did you see?
Well, this is an area where the Eagles are actually paying attention to the trend line, and the trend line is pretty obvious. Since Donovan McNabb appeared in the Super Bowl 39 against the Patriots, he is 9-12 as a starter. He's 3 games under 500. People want to ignore the fact that he has lost. The Eagles have lost 5 of his last 6 starts. In the last 3 starts, Donovan McNabb has completed under 50% of his passes in all 3 games. So the trend line is not up on Donovan McNabb. If anything, it's down, perhaps flat.
You call him a lame duck, either.
Well, I think this is an evaluation year. He needs to stay on the field. He needs to be healthy and perform at a high level. Or I think they are prepared to go to the next quarterback on their depth chart, and that would be Kevin Cobb, the rookie that they drafted in April. I know he's not considered the backup right now, but I think that's the guy that they will go to next season.
They're grooming him, you think?
Well, they are grooming him. That's the reason why they drafted him. Donovan McNabb is due $6.3 million in his Paragraph 5 contract next year, which means that's a number they can't get away from. They have to pay him that money if they keep him on the roster next year. If he doesn't finish the season, if he's not healthy through all 16 games, if they don't make the playoffs or go deep into the playoffs, they have to make a decision about whether Donovan McNabb is the future of the team. And they have to make that decision now, not in 2009.
Is this a make-or-break year for Donovan McNabb, Ray?
Yes, but it's still within his power to make it. That's the thing. I mean,
you still got it?
If given a decent supporting cast, given some help. I mean, if what you saw last Sunday, again, people have to keep in mind that the injury that he suffered last year against Tennessee, at the time, he suffered it at midseason. And the history of that injury is it's a 12-month, generally, recovery period. So the fact is he's back playing probably 3 months sooner than most medical people had projected. So the idea that he would come back and in September of this year be the old Donovan McNabb was probably unrealistic anyway.
Should he be playing then?
Well, I think he's good enough to play. I think he has to play himself back to however close to 100% he's capable of being. But he also needs the other guys around him to help. I mean, he needs his offensive line to play far better than it played in Green Bay. He needs some of the players around him, in particular Reggie Brown, who I think is capable of being a good receiver, but to me is underperforming. I mean, there are some guys there. L.J. Smith has been a receiver that's been productive with McNabb in the past. He missed all of the preseason with an injury. He's in a contract year, and there seems to be some question whether he's coming back. So some of the parts around him, Sean Andrews, their best offensive lineman, was hurt all preseason. So some of the key people around him are either just as big question marks as he is, or underperforming. And all of that impacts his ability to do his job at quarterback.
But when he got hurt, he had lost four out of his last five starts. And so
Before he got hurt.
I never believed in the myth that was being that was pervasive about him last year, that he was playing at a Pro Bowl level. You know, before he got hurt, he was under 50% completion percentage. And the team lost four of the five starts that he had. So I don't believe that he was playing at a high caliber when he got hurt last year.
Well, we're about a minute or so before our break, and I don't want to entirely depressed about the Eagles this year. But any bright spots, Ray? And people talked about the defense, at least on Sunday's game.
Well, the defense was the area with the team that most people had most questions coming out of the preseason. And yeah, the defense played quite well in Green Bay, actually. Kept them in the game when the offense and the special teams were trying to give it away. But I'm not sure that Green Bay was all that great a test, because I don't think Green Bay's offense is very good. If you're looking for a bright note the bright note is that the Eagles are in the NFC.
I was just going to say that.
The bright note is that the Eagles are in the NFC.
A lot of competition.
Where there is zero competition. And the Eagles, for all of their flaws, and we've discussed some of them, and there are more yet to discuss,
indeed,
they are probably still a playoff team in a very watered-down conference.
I have nothing to add to that. That is exactly
what I was going to say.
To me, it's their competition right now is not that good, and the NFC is wide open. And again, another aggravating aspect of this regime is they've been at it together for 8 years, and they are basically running in place. When you factor in the AFC, they're about the sixth or seventh best franchise, most talented franchise in the NFL, and it shouldn't be that way. They have a guy who's been to the Pro Bowl at quarterback. They are, according to Forbes magazine, the fifth healthiest financial team in the National Football League. They have money. They have a quarterback. They supposedly have a good coach who signed in 2011. They're supposed to be the gold standard. They shouldn't be six or seven teams behind everybody else.
Well, I'll tell you what. We're going to take a short break and get back to our guest. That's Sal Palantonio. And joining us also, Ray Didinger, talking about Eagles. And the lines are open at 1-888-477-9499. Both of them, each of them actually has a new book. And Ray Didinger's book is called One Last Read. And he'll be signing books this Saturday at 5 o'clock, Barnes & Noble in Wilmington. Sal's book is called The Palantonio Report. He'll be signing this Tuesday, 1 p.m., Borders Center City, Philadelphia. Again, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
The Cardiovascular Center at the Chester County Hospital supports WHYY. Just as we're a partner in cardiac surgery with Cleveland Clinic, we want our patients to be partners in care with us. To help you get the facts you need, our website now features important information about quality of care, patient satisfaction, and more. Located in Westchester, Pennsylvania, and online at 866drheart.com, the Cardiovascular Center is part of the health network of the Chester County Hospital. Beyond good care.
This week on American Roots, music by, for, and about kids. Hear Mother Goose swing and animal tales and rock and funk. We'll visit a New Orleans jazz summer camp for kids and meet children's music sensation, the Imagination Movers. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from American Public Media.
Saturday afternoon at 2 on WHYY.
Do roses really love garlic? Do marigolds really protect nearby plants from pests? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll try to sort out garden neighbor fact from fiction with a close look at companion planting. Plus, chemical-free answers to all your garden questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY 91 FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking about sports today. The Philadelphia Eagles, Ray Dittinger, writer, senior producer at NFL Films, also weekly commentator on Comcast SportsNet's post-game live show. Sal Palantonio, national correspondent for ESPN, covering the NFL for SportsCenter and Sunday NFL Countdown, also host of NFL Matchup on Sunday mornings. Both of them have books, The Palantonio Report, The Most Overrated and Underrated Players, Teams, Coaches, and Moments in NFL History. Ray Dittinger, one last read, the collected works of the world's slowest sports writer. I do want to get to those books, but I also want to get to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And we've got Steve from Marlton joining us. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Hey, this is great. Nice trick. I didn't even have to bend down to hit the preset on my radio.
Very good.
To talk to these gentlemen. Hey, I know this may be a question that I've heard bandied about. It may make you roll your eyes, but if the Eagles are tanking a few games into the season, and it's both game day coaching and preparation and whatnot, it's been bandied about because of distractions in personal life and whatnot. How do you feel, number one, about that question? And do you think it's a possibility at all that he would step down? You know, that he would step down either temporarily or whatever in light of the situation.
And you're talking about the coach Andy Reid, Steve?
Yeah, with the trouble. Yeah, and the distract. Well, what's it's. The awkward problems
sure.
with his two sons.
No, he's got sons who are in trouble with the law. And let me put that to Sal. Do you think Andy Reid is just? I mean, who knows? Of course, but do you think the problems with his two kids are going to affect him as a coach? From what you know about the way he coaches.
Well, I don't see how it couldn't distract you. You know, having children myself. Trying to do my job when you have problems at home is difficult.
Yep.
But he has got a pretty impenetrable personality, so we really don't know how much it has affected him. He's not one to give away his emotions ever, you know, even in the best of times. So, and I don't think he would step down, no. I just don't think he has the personal makeup to do that. He's pretty tough. He's pretty stubborn. And it's clear that he wants to do things his way or the highway. That's the evidence is overwhelming, so I don't think he would step down. And don't forget, he signed till 2011, so they have four more seasons after this one where they still have to pay him, and the total amount of that remaining part of that contract is almost $20 million.
Wow.
So, you know, I think that the team would be loath to let him go, and I think he'd be really very reluctant to leave.
To you, Ray, and you mentioned the fact that he's actually the winningest Eagles coach, right?
Yes, he has the most wins of any coach in the franchise history.
And does that say that this is a good fit for him in Philadelphia, or he knows how to make a Philadelphia football team behave on the field?
Well, I think he's a good coach. I think his record demonstrates that he's a good coach. I think he has been, and which is what makes events of the last couple weeks even more out of character. I think that he's demonstrated to me a very meticulous planner. I don't know that he's a particularly good spontaneous game day thinker.
Ah.
But in terms of preparing a team and practicing a team and getting a team ready to play, I've always felt those were his strengths. When he would do something that was so clearly wrong as to go into your first game of the season putting guys back to catch punts that had never caught punts before, to me, that's very out of character for him. Now, getting out-coached in a game, I mean, that happens sometimes.
Sure.
But to actually do something so fundamentally wrong, to me, that was the real head-scratcher about it, because that's not like him. That is not like him. And, you know, again, for us sitting in this chair to say, oh, he's distracted, oh, it's taking away 15% of his concentration, none of us can say that.
Sure.
But I agree with Sal. I don't know if you have... look, this is not a case of a kid bringing home a bad report card. I mean, you have major, major problems here. And I don't see how anyone who's a parent wouldn't be distracted by that.
And I'm opening your book here, Sal, because just to put this into some history or context here, you write about Bert Bell, the worst coach, but also the most underrated commissioner, the worst coach ever, but also he happened to be coaching the Eagles at the time, right?
Well, yeah, and he was owner of the Eagles at the time as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, his record was really bad as the Eagles head coach, but he was just, he's remembered, you know, for many different things, and his contributions to the NFL I thought were important to talk about in that book. People don't realize just how important he was. People talk about Pete Rozelle,
sure,
and his contributions to the league, but it was Bert Bell who initially recognized how poisonous gambling could be and made teams divulge injuries. And he came down hard on the first gambling incident. It was the New York Giants in a championship game in the 40s. And he was the guy who encouraged the players to form a union. He was the one that oversaw the first national television contract. So Bert Bell, I think, gets swept under the rug when people talk about the most important commissioners in NFL history.
I think, yeah, I definitely think, and following up, I think Bert Bell was the guy who really put in place the framework of what,
yes,
we now know as professional football. I mean, Rozelle took it and marketed it and did a wonderful job doing that, but they needed somebody to really put down a foundation for what the league was going to be. Everything Sal said is exactly right. The one other thing that Bell invented that not only football has adopted, but all sports have adopted, is the draft.
Yeah.
The idea of an orderly selection process where the talent coming out of colleges could be fairly distributed, with the weaker teams having the first pick, with the idea being of trying to maintain some kind of balance. Because before that, college players, the top college players, just came out and they could go sign with anybody. So Chicago Bears, the New York Giants, the bigger teams with more money just gobbled up the good players. And Bell saw, he said, if we keep going this way, the Green Bays of the world will never be able to compete, right, with the Chicagos or the New York. So he built the draft, which really, I think, became the foundation of the league's success.
So you can do all that, but you can't coach. Because what would you say, Sal? 10 wins in 5 seasons?
Yes.
Is that even possible?
Well, you know, he didn't have much talent. But, you know, he also put into place the idea that there would be parity in the NFL. He sort of created the NFL scheduling, and he did it right out of his house in Narberth.
Is that right?
Yeah, which is really cool to me because, you know, the country was birthed here, and so was the NFL. You know, it's
a nice little parallel beginnings, right?
Yeah.
Let me talk about Bill Belichick, and he just got fined $500,000. He's the coach of the New England Patriots, and this has to do with some spying on defensive plays. Maybe, Ray, you could do a better job than I could explaining what happened and what do you make of this pretty hefty fine?
Well, what they were found to be doing is something that they have been rumored to be doing for some time, which
is
having
right?
a video camera on the sidelines filming the signals that were being sent in by the opposing team's coach, and then using a video camera that also had a recording device, so you could hear what the coach was signaling and saying. And if you marry that with the plays as they're being run, then you can tell this signal means this, and this signal means that. And look, all teams do it.
Well, I was going to say, how common
well,
do you think
all
is?
Teams do it to this extent. If you go into the press box of a typical NFL game, there are scouts everywhere. They're in the press box, and they have little tape recorders with them. And so they're watching the plays, and they're watching the players. But while plays are being signaled in, you can hear them saying, hand to the shoulder, hand to the belt. And they're recording this. They're trying to do the best they can with
right.
it, but they're doing it on the fly. There's specific rules in the NFL rule book that prohibit video cameras on the sidelines so that you can't record it and then have it to go back over with. So that was where they overstepped their bounds. And I mean, to me, it was just dumb, and it was just arrogant that he would do this. I mean, the Patriots to me are so good and so much better than everybody else. You know, why they have to do this? It struck me, to borrow an analogy from Sal's former field, politics. I mean, to me, this was almost like the Republicans breaking into the Democratic headquarters in 1972 for Watergate.
Unnecessary.
Why
right?
did you have to? You know, I mean, was the election in doubt? I mean, everybody knew it was going to be a landslide, but yet they did it because they were arrogant enough to think, well, we can do whatever we want to do. And I think it was a little bit of the same thinking that tripped up the Patriots here. And you know what? I honestly think $500,000 fine for Belichick, $250,000 fine for the team, which means the owner of Robert Kraft, and the forfeiture of a first-round draft pick most likely next year. And I still say they got off easy.
Really? What do you think, Sal?
Well, to use the a Watergate analogy a little bit further, to quote a famous Jaworski, not Ron Jaworski, but Leon Jaworski, the special prosecutor in the Watergate case, what did Tom Brady know, and when did he know it? And I think Brady was the guy who benefited the most from the alleged spying, videotaping of the sidelines and the defensive calls, if in fact it had been done in the past. And as Ray mentioned, there has been suspicion that the Patriots have been doing this for years. We heard Hines Ward, who's a wide receiver from the Pittsburgh Steelers, suggest that in the AFC Championship game two or three years ago, that the Patriots had already figured out the Steelers' defense. There's now a suggestion by some players that the reason why the Brady knew that the Eagles were blitzing and audibled out to screen plays in the second half of Super Bowl 39 is because they had the defensive signals in the second half of Super Bowl 39. So I think it raises the question of just how successful the Patriots were with the videotaping and the signal stealing and the cheating, which was in clear violation of the rules, and how much this tarnishes not only Bill Belichick's legacy, but the Patriots' legacy. Paul Domowicz, this morning in Philadelphia Daily News, Ray's old newspaper, suggests that Belichick may have a hard time getting into the Hall of Fame as a result
of
this.
Well,
he's a Hall of Fame voter. I think he's the Philly representative. Is he
Paul,
not?
Paul succeeded me as the Philadelphia voter.
Right. Correct. So I mean, if you have a voter, Hall of Fame voter like Paul Domowicz raising this issue, you know that it's being talked about among the other guys who are the gatekeepers of NFL legacy around the National Football League.
But can this be investigated after the fact? Or, I mean, can you have an investigation so that you can know the answer to those questions or that speculation?
Well, I think the NFL has decided that the fine and the other penalties that they've levied against the New England Patriots is the end of it, and they're not going to go any further with investigation. And I don't think you're going to get a whole lot of teams squawking and squealing about when it might have happened and, you know, providing other evidence. I think because, as Ray said, all teams are involved in some kind of surreptitious activity. It's clear that on September 6th, the NFL put out a memo that said, we looked at this specific problem during the competition committee over the summer and in the spring, and we want to remind folks around the league that it's illegal to have any kind of videotaping device on the sideline, you know, pointed at your opponent's sideline. And they flouted that, flew right in the face, thumbed their nose at it, and said, we can do it anyway, and they got caught. And now they're paying the price. I don't think it was enough of a penalty.
What would have been better? Both of you said that. I mean, what more money? More
suspend Belichick.
So actually, suspend him.
Yeah, I would have. I would. To me, the fine. Yeah, fine him. Take away draft picks. Yeah, but I would have taken it one step further, and I would have suspended Belichick
for the season.
No, I would have suspended him at least for the next game with the Jets, the team of which they were caught quote unquote spying on. They have to play them again later this year because they're in the same division. I would have suspended them for the week of that game and that game. I mean, to me, that would have been, I think they stopped one step short of where they should have gone if they truly wanted to send a powerful message.
And there's and I agree with Ray totally. And there's two reasons for that, Marty. One, Roger Goodell, the new NFL commissioner, has come down very hard on trying to clean up the league. We saw it in the Michael Vick case over the summer. We saw it with Pac-Man Jones. We saw it with the recent substance abuse problems of a couple of players and coaches, specifically Wade Wilson. The quarterback's coach for the Cowboys was suspended for 5 games for purchasing HGH for a personal medical problem. Now, if you're going to say to a quarterback's coach that you lose 5 games without pay, then clearly for a case where there's cheating on the field that affects not only that particular game but the integrity of the sport, that you don't suspend the head coach in that specific situation, I think that's wrong. Hmm. And secondly, the draft picks are for next year. They don't affect what happens this year. And we don't even know if Bill Belichick's going to be the head coach of the Patriots next season. So it really affects the next head coach of the Patriots more than it affects him.
We've done shows about the whole Michael Vick situation, but do you think it was it the gambling that was more offensive to the NFL than the dog fighting ring, Ray?
Well, I think they were both they were both enormous concerns on the part of the league. Had to be. I mean, the fact that he would be trafficking in those circles where people were betting and betting large sums of money. I mean, people that are betting
and abusing
that kind of,
dogs on top.
Well,
of that.
People that are well, and
not abusing
sure,
them, killing them, right.
killing them. But I mean, the if people that are involved in that kind of betting don't stop there. I mean, they are bettors and they bet on everything. So you have one of your marquee players up to his eyeballs in those kinds of people. That was a big part of it. I think the public reaction when the indictment actually became public and people began to really appreciate the full magnitude of the horrible abuses that were going on down at that place in Virginia. I mean, there was just an enormous public outrage about it. And the other thing was Vic, in his own arrogant way, when he was confronted by the owner of the Falcons and Roger Goodell and said, there are these charges out there about you, what about it? And he said, I'm not involved at all, and mm-hmm. lied to both of them mm-hmm. and made them both look pretty foolish when they came forward and said, well, we talked to Mike and he said he wasn't involved. Oh, no, it turned out that he was not just involved. I mean, he tried to portray it as if he was the victim of bad friends when, in fact, he was the ringleader. So all of that brought him all down, right. And I've said from the beginning, and I believe this, I don't think he'll ever play another down in the National Football League.
Is that right?
I really feel that way.
For all those reasons. I
well,
mean, everything from lying to gambling to
well, I also
dogs.
Think there's the issue of just the time he's going to miss. I mean, he'll miss this year. He's not going to be sentenced till December. He's probably going to get at least a year in prison. Mm-hmm. When he gets out, the league will then suspend him because there's no point in suspending him while he's in prison and couldn't play, so he'll get another year on top of that. I mean, he's probably looking at a minimum of 3 years away from the game at a position where if you miss 3 weeks, people wonder if you can come back. And so all of that plus the taint of this case, I don't think Michael Vick's going to play in the NFL again.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't see how another owner or another coach or general manager says, let's take a flyer on Michael Vick and bring him to our franchise. First of all, he wasn't a particularly good quarterback.
Is that right?
Yeah.
In spite of all that had been said about him.
Yeah, I mean, he was a very good running quarterback, but he was not a very good passing quarterback, basically, to boil it down to the essentials. But I think you're just taking on too much baggage that you have to explain to your fans and your community. And I think that would be a very difficult thing for any owner. And then you have to pay him a lot of money, and you have to make an investment in him. It's not going to be cheap. And the problem for him is he can't go to the Canadian Football League because now he's a felon, so he can't go across the border. So I don't. And the other issue, too, Marty, is there is still the case in Virginia. What will the prosecutor do in Surry County, Virginia? There are at least 8 specific counts of animal cruelty that all have the penalty of 1 to 5 years in prison. So he's looking at the possibility of spending time in jail in Virginia as well.
And we're almost up on our second break here, but just a very slightly awkward segue, but going to your book, Sal, you say Joe Montana, the best quarterback? In NFL history?
Well, Joe Montana was the best quarterback in NFL history, but he's actually not in my book as the best quarterback. And we didn't say who was the best or worst. We tried to...
Among the best.
Well, without a doubt. We compare Joe Montana actually to Len Dawson because people forget about Len Dawson, who was the great Chiefs quarterback, and his numbers at postseason were as good as Montana's was. And, I think what we try to do in the book is sort of set the record straight about a lot of players and teams and give people a unique and fresh perspective. It's kind of – when we started writing the book, we thought, okay, this would be a great book to start out the season because it would be fun and it would create debate. But there's been so many bad headlines about the league that I'm hoping that people will pick it up in that vein.
Well, I'll tell you what, a very short break, then we'll get back to our guests. That's Sal Palantonio and Ray Dittinger. They both have new books, and they both cover sports, specifically football, and that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times. 1-888-477-9499. What are you looking forward to this football season in Philadelphia? Give us a call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Philadelphia Live Arts Festival and Philly Fringe, now through September 15th. Featuring Cynthia Hopkins' Must Don't Whip 'Em, a high-spirited musical journey in the style of a pop diva's farewell concert. Must Don't Whip 'Em runs September 12th through the 15th at the Tomlinson Theater at Temple University. For details, 215-413-1318 or online at livearts-fringe.org.
Next time on Day to Day, Quincy Jones supports Clinton.
One of my favorite ladies on this planet.
Oprah Winfrey backs Obama.
This is my senator, my favorite senator.
Today, black celebrities have a new role in the presidential race and a big choice.
A black man or a white woman? It's so hard to make up my mind.
Caught between Chris Rock and a hard place next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A new policy on what religious literature is acceptable in federal prisons in post-9/11 America has left some inmates and chaplains in a tizzy. Also, the new film Across the Universe uses Beatles music to tell a 60s tale. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking about sports and football today on the show. And during that break, we were watching on CNN two mascots going at it, a duck beating up a bear. And I guess this is Ray Dinger, the state of football today. Right?
Sort of what our sports culture has come to, I suppose. Even the mascots are abusing each other. Yeah, the Oregon Duck and the Cal Bear got into it last weekend.
Tussle.
It started off as just typical mascot buffoonery, and then the duck didn't know when to stop. And so it wound up in an assault case, and now the duck is going to be suspended for at least one game, pending further review.
Well, let me go
duck
back.
Soup, I guess, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we could go on and on with this, but I'm going to stop it right there. Sal, looking ahead, though, to
why?
I know. Very tempting. Looking ahead to Monday night's game,
yeah.
Eagles against Washington.
You
know,
you wanted me to break it down X's and O's for you,
no,
Marty?
Don't do X's and O's. Not on this show, anyway. But, what do you think?
Opening weekend here in Philadelphia is like Christmas weekend to me. It's so much fun. You got this unwrapped gift that's given to you, which is the home opener. You don't know exactly what you're going to get. Making it more complex and mysterious and interesting is that they blew a game last week in Green Bay that they should have won. And now I believe they are in a must-win situation. I know it's week two, and I say right. that, and people scoff at it and look at me cross-eyed. I think it's a must-win situation. We went back and looked at it. Since 1990, 138 teams have started 0-2. Only 13% of them have made the playoffs, just 18. Now, the Eagles, the last time they did it was in 2003, right, Ray?
Yes.
They lost the opener, home opener, the open of the link to the Tampa Bay Bucks. Then the New England Patriots came in and waxed them in
both
week two.
Both home games. They were 0-2 with two home games.
Wow.
But the difference is those two teams were good, and the Patriots wound up winning the Super Bowl that season. And these two teams, the Eagles, should be beating. They're both non-playoff teams, you know, going into the season, and they should have no problem with them. So again, there's you're coming down the stairs. The gifts are still wrapped, and you just want to tear them open as fast
right.
as you possibly can. And I can't
wait.
Is that
fire truck in that box?
Yeah, is it a fire truck or a bag of coal? Is what it is.
Ray, your thoughts, and we'll get back to our callers.
I agree. I think it's a very important game for them. Looking at the two teams. I mean, the Eagles are clearly a better team, but they were a better team than Green Bay was. I just don't think that, from what I've seen of Washington, I just don't think they're very good. I mean, people are trying to say they're better in this area and they're better in that area. I think they
won, though, last week, right?
They did win last week, but they won at home against a dreadful Miami team, and they needed overtime to do it. I can't see them coming in here on a Monday night with this Eagles team, obviously now knowing what the stakes are, and I agree with Sal. I mean, their season, if not hanging in the balance, is close.
Yeah.
I can't see the Eagles coming out and losing to this team at home on a Monday night home opener. That just doesn't seem... anything's possible in pro football. We learned that, but I mean, to me, that seems very unlikely.
All right, let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. We've got Rob from Doylestown joining us. Hi, Rob. Go ahead, your Radio Times.
This morning in the Inquirer, Frank Fitzpatrick, who usually writes a humorous column, just took it and ripped the Eagles fans as being obsessive and way over the line. As far as their enthusiasm is concerned and their behavior is concerned. And I was wondering if you guys had any thoughts on that.
I mean, that doesn't seem like a new story to me, but...
Well, he says that they've taken it one step further than the fans at the Vet and Franklin Field. And he usually doesn't get into serious matters.
Well, should we be embarrassed about Philadelphia sports fans?
No, I don't.
Oh, Sal, go ahead.
No, I don't think so. Definitely not. I mean, I think I travel all over the country. I've done it for 15 years. I've been in a lot of NFL stadiums, been in a lot of sporting events. Philadelphia fans are smart, they're tough, and they're frustrated, and for good reason.
Right.
They've been
and this is all sports here in this town,
they've been
right?
saddled with bad ownership, bad management, and you know, bad selection of players, and some bad luck. And so, no, I don't think I disagree with that. I think the Philadelphia fans have I like them. I like being around them. I think they juice you up. I think it's fun to be around them. It's engaging. This is what you do. This is why we do it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Ray, go ahead.
I agree. I mean, I'm from the city. I grew up in a family of Philadelphia sports fans. I think I understand who they are, and I understand where they're coming from. And to me, the definition of bad fans are the fans that don't come.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, you know, bad fans are the fans that are there when you win and aren't there when you lose.
The front runners, is
yeah,
that what they're
exactly.
called?
I mean, towns like Atlanta and Miami are two classic examples. Mm-hmm. The team's good, the place is packed. If the team's bad, the place is empty. Those are bad fans. I mean, don't tell me people are bad fans if they're there every Sunday throughout 2-10 seasons to 10-2 seasons. You know, they're coming out there, and they're coming out there because they want to support you. They're doing everything they can. Now, if you put a bad product on the field and you disappoint them, they have every right to be angry and upset about that and frustrated. This team hasn't won a championship since 1960.
It's unbelievable.
So, I mean, yet these people are still hanging in there, keeping faith with you.
In the 20th century,
I mean,
too,
those
right?
aren't bad fans in my mind.
I had a late night the other night, and my wife and I were out. I forget where we were. And I come home, and I just want to turn the Phillies game on and see what was going on. And they were losing 12-0 or 12-2. I forget what it was, some absurd number that you don't expect a team in the middle of a pennant chase to be losing to the Colorado Rockies. The place was packed. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I was like, I turned on TV and I said, what are those people doing there? But that's what you get in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And something we should celebrate.
Absolutely.
Let me get Ronald from North Philadelphia to join us. Hi, Ronald. Go ahead. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
All right. I just wanted to comment on what Sal said about Joe Montana being the greatest quarterback. I'm a Joe Montana fan.
Yeah.
But I just think Roger Staubach was one of the greatest quarterbacks that ever played football. But although I was a kid watching him, was excited about watching it. And I state that for Donovan, although he's in the end of his career or coming to the tail end, he's still been one of the greatest quarterbacks I've ever seen play football and definitely represented Philadelphia.
Okay, fair enough. Ronald, thanks for calling into Radio Times. You want to talk about Roger Staubach?
Oh, Roger Staubach was a great player, Hall of Fame player. You know, Roger Staubach was a guy who needed an F-14 to get in the air. Joe Montana could fly like a Jedi Knight. Huh. That's the difference between the two of them. I just think that Montana had a certain otherworldly magic and touch about him that separates him from everybody else. As far as Donovan McNabb is concerned, you know, I think the overwhelming evidence will be when his career is done, that he came up short when he had an opportunity to win a Super Bowl, had an opportunity to go to a Super Bowl, and I think in the end people will go back and say they had enough talent and they didn't pull the trigger.
Ray, what's the mood in the locker room these days? And is that important gauge of how a team is doing?
Depending on the team. I mean, some teams you can get a much better feel than others. This team doesn't, in my mind, doesn't reveal a whole lot. It's funny. I think teams in football, particularly, really do take on the character of their coach.
Is that right?
I've found that to be true, and I think this team is a little bit like its coach. And in fact, it doesn't reveal a whole heck of a lot. I mean, covering the Dick Vermeil teams. I mean, Dick Vermeil was a guy whose heart was on his sleeve all the time. And his players were much the same way. With this team, I think it's a little bit like that. My feeling is I think that this team is in search of itself right now. I think they are sort of They're a team sort of between phases now. They've got veteran players who, they've lost Jeremiah Trotter, who was a major leader on that team, who wasn't the player that he had been in the past, but was a very strong leadership force within that team. Well, he's gone now, and that does create a vacuum in terms of your leadership. You have Brian Dawkins, who's now the senior guy on the team. But Brian is not the player that he was. I mean, he's still there, and he's still into it, and he's fully engaged, and he was a great player. He's less than that now. And now you're bringing some of these younger guys along who have to assume a little bit more of that responsibility. And then you've got McNabb, who's sort of this guy that he's there, he should be your leader, but then there's the people, does he have one foot out the door?
Sure.
And so when you're talking about there is a dynamic of, I think, of real uncertainty. And it's hard to compete and win in the National Football League when you don't have an organization where everybody knows exactly what's expected of them, knows exactly what they're capable of, and knows exactly what they're going to do from week to week. You go into good teams, you go into locker rooms of the good teams, there's a focus, there's a drive, there's a, this is our plan, this is what we're going to do, get out of our way kind of feeling. Huh. The Eagles had that at one time, a few years ago, when this was a young group that was right on the rise and they were hungry. I mean, you felt
that. You could feel that.
You could feel that. And you feel that with some other teams now. You don't feel it as strongly with the Eagles.
Interesting. Let me get Ray from Bryn Mawr to join us. Hi, Ray. Go ahead, your Radio Times.
Hi there. Briefly, I've got a pet peeve, and perhaps you can bring some insight into it.
We'll try.
There are cities like Boston and Chicago that have had losing sports teams, and they're considered lovable losers. And Philadelphia, which has a long history of losing sports teams, are just considered losers. There's a certain anger toward Philadelphia, whereas other teams have affability, even in their losses.
Well, Ray, we're putting the Philadelphia sports fan on the psychiatrist couch, but I think that's an interesting comment. I'm tossing that over to Sal Palantonio.
Well, I think it goes to the cultural heritage of the city itself. The capital of the country was here in the so-called silver decade from 1790 to 1800, and it was sort of ripped out of here. And then the U.S. Bank was here in the 1830s, and it was ripped out of here. And Philadelphia was kind of lost between New York and Washington for well over a century. H.L. Mencken called it a well-lit cemetery, and that's what it was considered. And it was considered sort of the stepchild of the nation after being in the limelight for so long. And the sports culture sort of fit into that, I think, mentality. Mm-hmm. And it's had a hard time coming out of it. And it could have if it had some success. Then you add on top of the fact that they've had one World Series championship in a century. They have the losingest franchise in baseball history in the Phillies with 10,000 losses, the first team to get there. That the Eagles have not won a championship since 1960. You throw on top of that 1964. You throw on top of that Mitch Williams' home run pitch to Joe Carter in the World Series.
I remember that well.
I mean, you it just kind of funnels into this one spot of, is it a loss of identity at the beginning and then they never recaptured it? And I think that that's probably the problem.
I think they've done a better job in some of those other cities of creating a culture of romance around their failure. In Boston, they've attached this kind of literary affection to it with the Stephen Kings and the Curse of the Bambino, and they've made the losing as if there was some kind of a romantic, kind of quixotic element to it. It isn't really failure, it's just kind of our destiny. In Chicago, the Cubs have always been, quote-unquote, the lovable losers. That's how they've always been portrayed. Philadelphia hasn't been quite as good about putting a different face on our losing. It does just come down to losing, I suppose. But I think it is worth pointing out, and this is one other aspect that I think speaks well of Philadelphia fans, is Mitch Williams, and Sal mentioned Mitch Williams, threw a catastrophic pitch in the 1993 World Series. I mean, as devastating a blow as could ever delivered to a city or a fan base. Mitch Williams today is an enormously popular talk show host in Philadelphia. He's back here. He does radio. He does television. He walks the streets. People ask his autograph. They pat him on the back. They say, Mitch, it's great to see you. Bill Buckner walks the streets of Boston, and he needs police protection to this day because he let the ground ball go through his legs. Now, Philadelphia fans are bad fans.
Yeah.
I mean, anybody that should be reviled, it should be Mitch Williams. Mitch Williams is a hero today. I think that speaks volumes to what Philadelphia fans are really about. Not the perception of them, but the reality of it.
I agree.
And we're almost out of time here. I'm curious, what was the first football game you ever went to, Sal?
The first football game I ever went to was the Fog Bowl. I had to cover it for the Philadelphia Inquirer. That was New Year's Eve, 1988. The Eagles at the Bears, Soldier Field, and the Eagles got a game basically robbed from them by bad weather because they should have beaten the Bears.
But they couldn't see the Bears, could they?
They couldn't see it. But I was forced into going. I didn't want to go. I wasn't a sports writer at the time. I was covering politics in New Jersey, and it's a long story. Right. But basically, it launched my career as a sports writer.
And for you, because you write about it in your book, Ray, you were a little kid. You went to Connie Mack Stadium.
10 years old.
Saw your first football game with your family.
10 years old with my parents, with my grandparents. September 1956, Eagles versus the Redskins.
Year I was
Mack
born.
I was 10 and
went to the
Eagles-Redskins game. The Eagles won 13-6. We sat there in a pouring rain for an entire on a Saturday night. And it was one of the best nights of my life because
really?
That was the night that I fell in love with pro football.
And just because it was there, you were with your family, the spectacle, the game.
Walking up the ramp and seeing the field and seeing the green grass. Remember, this was the days of black and white television. So you walked into the stadium and you saw the green field and the white lines. And the Redskin band was on the field playing and hearing the music and just feeling the excitement. I mean, it made my heart pound. And I just said, God, there's something really special about this. And it was just a connection there that stays with me to this day.
Do you still feel that today?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And you have an opening chapter to this book about how you are the world's slowest sports writer. And actually being the last person to leave a stadium, sometimes at, 4, 5, 6 in the morning still getting the finishing touches on the articles that
always.
You've written?
Yeah, I have the distinction of having been locked in every stadium in the National Football League, including some that have been torn down and leveled now. But yeah, I mean, I was such a slow writer that they would just assume at 5 o'clock in the morning, surely everybody's going home by now, and they would just turn out the lights and lock the doors, and I would be left behind. I can't tell you. I mean, it got to the point now where I could find my way blindfolded out of Candlestick Park, Yankee Stadium. I mean, I know every catwalk and fire escape from here to San Francisco. Not because I wanted to, but because it was out of necessity.
And we're almost out of time, but sports...
Good thing you didn't write for a morning paper.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. You had a little leisure time. And sports and politics, is that pretty much the same beat?
Yeah, it's very similar. You have a winner and loser. You have a campaign. They go into their bunker. They decide their strategy. They try to keep it secret. It's our job to try to get it out into the public. And instead of going over a 6 or 8 month period of time, it's 1 week. Right. So it's sort of the same concept, except that athletes are a little nicer to you than politicians.
Well, look, I really appreciate you both joining us today in Radio Times. A lot of fun. Thank you, Sal.
Thank you.
And thank you, Ray.
My pleasure, Maureen.
And Sal Palantonio has a new book. It's called The Palantonio Report, The Most Overrated and Underrated Players, Teams, Coaches, and Moments in NFL History. He'll be signing books this Tuesday at Borders in Center City, Philadelphia. And Ray Dittinger also has a book called One Last Read, The Collected Works of the World's Slowest Sports Writer. And he'll be signing books Saturday, tomorrow, 5 o'clock, Barnes & Noble in Wilmington, Delaware. Thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Find out more about the program, including podcasts, and you can leave us an email. Have a great weekend. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to WHYY FM Philadelphia, your member supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.